Hello, this is David Rovix with another episode of Discussions with David. We're broadcasting on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and today as well on the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio, as well as on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, and elsewhere. You can find all of these live stream discussions in podcast form afterwards if you subscribe to This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform or go to davidrovix.com. I plan to continue with doing live stream programming every weekday for the foreseeable future, with every Monday being an open mic, which you are encouraged to participate in. Find out more and sign up at davidrovix.com/POMM, which stands for Pandemic Open Mic Mondays. Starting soon, every Tuesday, I'll be working with the founder of the Fifth Estate newspaper and longtime Detroit area talk show host, Peter Werby, to bring you interviews with contributors to the Fifth Estate newspaper. And most of the interviews I'll be doing during the other days of the week will continue to be with interesting people I know personally, who at some point in the fairly recent past, I used to see around a lot more often, like because the world wasn't shut down yet. Jenka Soderberg is indubitably one of those people. Jenka and I both live in the same city in Portland, Oregon, though we will be speaking together from our respective homes in different parts of town. Although we live in the same city, I think we probably saw each other more often before either of us moved to Portland in the context of various social movements, especially the global justice movement, in which Jenka played an important role, not only in the Washington, D.C. area where she used to live, but in many different parts of the world. For most of the time since both Jenka and I moved to Portland, she has been working in one capacity or another for KBOO Community Radio. I've known Jenka for around 20 years, and I continue to discover new areas of expertise that she has, which don't seem to be limited to any particular area, ranging from a deep knowledge of social movement history, anarchist theory, computer programming, and traditional Irish dance, to name just a few things. Prior to her work with KBOO, most people who knew Jenka would likely associate her with the work of the Independent Media Center, or Indie Media, which played such a big role in the development of the global justice movement back in the relatively early days of the internet. Jenka, welcome to my little live stream show.
Hey, great to be here.
Hey. Yeah, in the treehouse, can we say you're in a treehouse, actually? But we're in our respective homes, but you're actually in a sort of the ancillary treehouse extension to the home.
Extension, sure.
it's
I
sort
can
of like
a little peace and quiet.
It's like a granny flat for a small child, I guess. Treehouse.
Something.
But Jenka, just before we move into any other subject areas, in terms of the very immediate present, how is life under quarantine for you? I know it's a subject that I think is of great interest to lots of people, just how everybody is dealing with this, even though it's also a subject people are talking about maybe too much. But tell us something about it. How are you managing and working under quarantine?
Kind of a mixed bag, you know. Of course, no one wants to be in the midst of a global pandemic. It's a horrible situation, and I have friends in healthcare, and it's not a thing that you want to be dealing with. At the same time, I feel a little guilty about actually liking the new normal, that I don't like driving every day to a workplace. I like spending a lot of time with my child. I'm really enjoying that part, actually, and I know other people are feeling the same, and we can talk more about that. I've actually been studying the way people learn, the way children learn, for the last 4 years. I did a master's degree in education, and my ideas are a little different from the educational system. So I'm actually really interested in having all of these kids out of school and learning. actually yeah. learning.
And but on that, just before we go on, the screen froze, and it froze at a really nice picture of you, though, which is so unusual when screens. Usually, it's like somebody's just like about to yawn or something, you know. But it's fine with a frozen screen; we can hear you just fine. But just in case there's anything to be done, I'm not sure what I can do on this end. But the audio is the main thing. The screen froze with you, like, you know, sort of smiling and looking like completely like you're on a, you know, in a public conversation. You know, it never freezes like
okay,
that.
Okay, well, but maybe it'll okay. come back. I don't know.
It might come back. As long as we got audio, that's what matters. You can even see the viewers don't care about the screen freezing. They're just interested in the audio too, which is... But at least whatever you can judge from that little number in the upper left of my screen, I have no idea what that number ever means. But, you know, I try to philosophize based on the number changing in the upper left of the screen. You know, it's kind of a modern thing. But in terms of the homeschooling and the no schooling and the remote learning, I mean, this idea of doing school remotely with computers and sort of replacing it, and that seems like they're really, really missing the mark to me in terms of like the concept of anything good about school or education, or because the whole thing, it seems to me like, is about groups, but kids getting to hang out with each other, and that's not happening now.
Yeah, and I want to point out that that is a breaking point for a lot of families, that a lot of kids don't have access to the internet, can't get on the online learning systems, and the schools are now handing out Chromebooks, giving lots of money to Google, and that's one way that this thing could go. I kind of like this idea that Naomi Klein put out in her recent article, How to Beat Coronavirus Capitalism, that this is a breaking point. It's one of those shifts that we experienced like after Katrina in New Orleans, could go in one of a number of directions. We could use this as an opportunity to say, you know what, our system isn't working. Let's figure out a new way. Let's figure out a better way, and let's do it together. Or we can, you know, reverse trends and go backwards and revoke all of these progressive changes that have taken place, and big industry and big capitalism can make huge strides, which is what the online learning is part of, is this these big companies trying to take advantage of this situation.
So there's so many sort of double edges to the double edge, to the many different double edged swords, or you know, I mean, there's so many different flip sides to this coin, like different ways we can go. We could have rents and mortgages reexamined, and we get finance out of the housing industry, and have the cost of housing have something to do with the cost of living. I mean, this seems obviously they're suspending evictions here in Oregon and many other states, and there's these kinds of developments, but then where they go and same with remote learning, or with we could all figure out that school was structured wrong in the first place, or we could replace it with something better, and workplaces, so we could replace it with something better, or we could replace it with something much worse. Like, I mean, working from home can be nice, but then again, you know, being having an app tracking your every move is another alternative future. Like, it's so much is up in the air, isn't it? It's really obviously a statement of the obvious that we're on a precipice and everything is up in the air, but exactly how things are up in the air and where things might come down next, it's so hard to impossible to predict, huh? But tell me more about your impressions of the current moment. And I mean, you know, I think we should mention also, obviously many people viewing, especially on Cable's Facebook page, may already know this, but you are you work for Cable, you do the web, and you have been the news coordinator. I think if anybody has their pulse on their finger on the pulse of a certain elements of society, you are one of those people, and I want to talk more about that, would you?
Thanks. I really like Naomi Klein's quote about this. The world economy is seizing up in the face of cascading shocks. If there's one thing that history teaches us, it's that moments of shock are profoundly volatile. We either lose a whole lot of ground, get fleeced by elites, and pay the price for decades, or we win progressive victories that seemed impossible just a few weeks earlier. So right now we're in those shocks, and things that seemed impossible are now possible. People who are disabled, who have asked for years to have meetings remotely so that they can actually be a part of the workplace, have been told, no, we can't do it, no, we can't do it. And suddenly, yeah, we can do it, huh? And we could the whole time. And I just think that this is the time when those elements of the economy that are left out, that are forgotten, that are pushed aside, can step up and actually be the change. David Graeber's also been writing about this, and the idea that here's this group of workers that have been so looked down on in the service work capacity. And now we realize just how dependent we are on the service workers, and not only looked down on, but there is the creation of an underclass in order to prop up a non-working class, or a class that is the parasitic class that doesn't actually do the work, but is kind of living off of the labor of others. And now we're looking at that and saying, you know what, here's something that's valuable, the people who are doing this kind of work, and let's look at this as an opportunity to change our way of structuring society. Like you mentioned, the eviction moratorium. Well, what happens when someone's out of work for the next 3, 4, 6 months, and then the moratorium's lifted and rent comes due? They then have to pay 6 months worth of rent? How about rent forgiveness? How about mortgage forgiveness? How about we look at our structures of housing, like you mentioned, and say, if you own more than one house, give it up. Let someone else live there. We have a housing crisis. Let other people live in them. In the Mexican Revolution, Emiliano Zapata said, burn all the records, burn all the papers, the colonialist papers. If you love the person you're with, you're married to them. You don't need a paper to tell you. If you live in a certain spot, that's your home. You don't need a person, a paper to tell you that. And I understand the need for bureaucracy or whatever, but I don't think that that is actually necessary when we have a society that's based in values and that's based in trust as opposed to fear and scarcity. Because there isn't actually scarcity. There's just a fear of scarcity, which is the basis of capitalism.
Yes.
Well, you were asking about my personal experience, and I'm starting to
That's a wonderful tangent. We're going off on all the right tangents here, but that example from burning all the records. First of all, I'm just going to remove you from the stream momentarily and bring you back and see if we can see you. I got you back. There we go. Okay, now you're moving. Okay, that's better. Yes. Good.
I'm here.
Okay, you're here. I mean, you've been here, but now we can see you as well as hear you. So yeah, next time I'll try that a little sooner if anybody freezes up on one of my programs like that. There's actually that example of burning the records, though. There's so many different social movements historically, when the elite historians write about social movements, they talk about rioting mobs and arson and setting fire to public buildings and this kind of thing. They write about it from a very negative standpoint, right? But the actual burning of public buildings and the burning of public records has a long tradition with social movements, because those public records, what are those public records? As far as really going back as far as anybody has been keeping public records, which pretty much goes as far back as the written word, we've been keeping track of who owns what, right? And this is often a very skewed thing in terms of who supposedly owns things. And you burn the public records, and then you've kind of reset the ownership and debt and this sort of thing in a society.
You know, when I was in college, I did a work study, and I worked at the law library. And so I did a lot of copying of documents, and I noticed this pattern that many of the documents, in fact, like 99% of the things, were the wealthiest and the corporate having disputes with each other to like get money in one form or another. And that was the vast majority of the law library. I remember coming across the first case months into my job of copying documents. I found a case where it was nonviolent activists using the necessity defense. And it was the first time I had heard of that. And I was so amazed that this was part of the law library too, because everything else was just these obscure, you know, property disputes and ways to use the law to make more money for your corporation, basically.
That's interesting. And then the necessity defense. And I mean, people, you know, I talk to people often about the idea of how property relations could be redefined in a new society led by, you know, people, whoever they are, whether that's their wealthy people with enlightened self-interest, or whether it's after a revolution, but whoever is in charge, the property relations in a society like this, which are so terribly skewed, have to change. But then people point to, oh, the Constitution and this or that law, and as if these things are sacrosanct and don't change. And I mentioned, well, you know, the Constitution has some pretty important amendments to it that came afterwards, you know, that really change the basis of the document. You know, and the laws can be changed. You know, that's the nature of any pseudo-democratic society. We can change these things. Just because we have a society based on property accumulation doesn't mean we can't come along and change the law and say nobody is allowed to own more than two houses until everybody has one. I mean, this can be done. And what? Say that again. Sorry, I'm just getting the picture back again.
Is the picture back?
Now we're back again for a moment. Anyway, but your audio stays with us the whole time, and that's the most important part. But
probably the internet. Just going back to the thing that David Graeber was writing about, it's the revolt of the caring classes. So it's and there's this idea that economy means exchange, but there's another kind of economy that the exchange economy depends on, and that's the caring economy. And I think people who are working, who are now staying home, are noticing that, you know, there are these people who have been doing a lot of work that is unpaid labor, and that is the caregivers, the people who are at home, people who are doing a lot of the care work in our society, and those are the people who are left out of the capitalist system, but yet the system of exploitation that we have is totally dependent on this gift economy in order to survive. Like, that it wouldn't be possible without the gift economy existing. But instead of expanding the exchange economy, as people have said, to you know, pay parents for child rearing or that kind of thing, which I think could be a step in the right direction. But I think what we need to do is actually expand the gift economy and reduce the exchange economy, and to turn that into the actual way that society operates, so we're not dependent on wage labor in order to you know, have our bread.
Yeah, like for example, if most of us weren't spending most of our time trying to chase down enough money to pay next month's mortgage or next month's rent, which you know, along with medical bills, and you know, is some of the main things that most of us are struggling to pay every month. If these things were suddenly massively reduced, then there would be no need for people to be rushing around trying to make so much money. I mean, there's so many different ways that this could be done, where the gift economy could become more dominant. But yeah, it's so true, isn't it, that people are just realizing how much free work is inherent in everything basic functioning of every aspect of society, right? I mean, it's, you can look at every different industry, and then I have said about the music industry what also others have said. You know, Matt Callahan wrote a book about it, but like this industry is completely dependent on volunteer labor, and most of the people involved with it, to say nothing of those who are taking care of the children while the husbands or wives or whoever, usually husbands, are off touring around in a band, you know, this kind of free labor. There's also so much other, like most gigs organized that are not in a stadium or something are organized by people who are working for free, as far as I can tell, you know. And it's so many different elements of that whole reality is based on free labor, and it's only though when we are in a situation like this where we realize that those really low paid and free laborers are the ones who make this world go. While the landlords sitting there who own properties like this one, the investment bankers who are watching their money come in from these properties that they own, they hire people to take care of their properties. Obviously, they're paying as little as they possibly can systematically, clearly. And these are the essential workers now, these people who now can come into our apartments and fix these old appliances that are constantly on the verge of breaking, like they are in most cities throughout this country, because of the way that these slum lords run their property. So then, you know, putting them at further risk coming in to fix things in people's homes. But they're essential. And they're dying.
Not just the things inside the homes. I mean, our electric infrastructure is the same that Edison came up with, and our grid is 100 years old, and our infrastructure of our, our whole society's infrastructure is crumbling because of the aging of it. But there's a reason for that. And yeah. I mean, people always talk about, the wealth gap, you know, from the wealthy to the poorest is growing, and it keeps growing and it keeps growing. Well, there's a reason for that, because there are parasites at the top that have decided that the increased productivity that has gone on since the 1950s by workers, as we keep working harder, we keep having producing more, and yet the wages are not keeping pace. Our wages are keeping stagnant and decreasing, while those at the very top are stealing that wealth. So the problem is not just that we have a wealth gap, it's that we have specific people at the top who are doing this theft. I mean, imagine if that money was actually reinvested into the rest of us, as opposed to taken out of the economy and put into offshore bank accounts. We could have all of the things. I mean, we really could. It's just that there is no scarcity. And when people are like, oh my gosh, there's no, there's a scarcity of meat in the grocery stores because of the supply chains, because the pork factories workers got sick and they couldn't process the meat. Well, guess what? At the farms, they are burying animals. You know, they're just slaughtering them, and yet people could be taking that. It's just, the system is so messed up because of the way that it's structured and the parasites that. And so when you look at alternatives and ways to actually restructure this thing and change the supply chain so that people can get what they need, which is there. I like the mask thing that's happening. Nobody pays for masks because, I mean, a few people are selling them, but some people are capitalizing on it. But like, so many millions of people are making masks and giving them away and sharing them. And that's happening. And it's like, okay, we're in this together. So we're going to keep each other safe. I have a sewing machine. I know how to make masks. I'm going to make a few and share them. And someone else has material and they're, you know, sending it over to their neighbor, and someone else has elastic bands. And it's like a cooperative effort. And not only that, but the The 3D people who have 3D printers all over the country right now are making these face shields for doctors and sending them to hospitals and just trying to get reimbursed for the materials. But that's where we come in. When there's a vacuum of leadership, people start stepping up to do the tasks that are needed.
Yeah. And actually, you know, it's speaking of which, you know, in terms of like organizing and mutual aid and people organizing in the absence of any useful leadership coming from the government in our case, or oftentimes where the leadership coming from the state is far, far worse than useless. But you are actually one of the people I've interviewed on my programs over the past few weeks. I think maybe half of them were in New Orleans in 2005, and you are one of them. And I wonder what reflections you have on, in terms of the kind of organizing and mutual aid that went on after Hurricane Katrina that you participated in New Orleans and the present moment. And I'm just going to take you out and bring you in. And yeah.
That's where you see this kind of stark contrast of the two directions that things can go in. So there was an opening after the hurricane, the two hurricanes hit New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina and then Hurricane FEMA. When Hurricane FEMA came along and showed their incompetence, and it was again a vacuum of leadership at the federal level, which we saw then with George Bush, who did not care what was going on and made that very abundantly clear, didn't care because it was non-white people that this was mainly happening to. And so he didn't do any kind of leadership. And so there was then this opening where the capitalist system broke down. People were desperate. People were, you know, in this horrible situation of having their homes flooded. And who stepped up? It was the anarchists. It was the Rainbow Family, people living on the edges of society and outside of the workaday life that were able to come to New Orleans and start helping people, but also working with people. So the idea of common ground was solidarity, not charity. And that's what all of these mutual aid groups that are starting now are using that as a starting point too, is what is needed and how do we get what's needed? So it's more a logistical question than a question of charity. It's like figuring out what's needed. So we started a No Heat, New Orleans Housing Emergency Action Team to fight against evictions, that people were facing evictions even though their homes weren't damaged. We started the No Law, the New Orleans Legal Action Workshop, so people could come and talk to lawyers. We went to the Greyhound station that they had turned into a prison, and we're putting people in there for things like breaking curfew by being in their neighborhood where they lived. So we were just responding to what was needed and asking, you know, what is happening and what is needed, and then figuring that out. The contrast is, I went at one point, we needed some porta-johns because the Rainbow Kitchen that set up in this is Jackson Square, they set up a camp and a kitchen there with a bunch of tents, and people were coming every day for meals because the Rainbow Family that gathers every summer, they're really good at doing things off the grid and preparing food and doing it in a safe way without much resources. So we wanted to get a porta-john for that park. And so I went to the FEMA camp, which was about 12 miles outside of New Orleans, and they had these massive white tents set up and the tents were air conditioned, which this was the heat of summer in New Orleans and nothing was air conditioned. The tents that FEMA had were air conditioned, and they had like about 100 porta-johns all set up in a row. And then they had like laundry trucks and shower trucks that were there. And There was nobody there. It was empty. And
Why?
I
Why?
went.
They're 12 miles outside of town. I mean, but I mean, if that's the problem, right? People couldn't get there. And then if they could get there, what are they going to do there? Or
When I asked them, they said, "Well, this is the camp for the contractors.
Oh my
The
goodness.
people from New Orleans have another camp." I said, "You know what?
They
No, they
don't.
don't
They
actually."
have the stadium with the flooded toilets.
Yeah, and so FEMA had set that up and decided they were going to go with the out-of-state contractors and set up space for them as opposed to actually providing what the people need. And then, when they eventually did send people trailers, they had formaldehyde and people were getting poisoned. So,
And
yeah,
Jenka,
FEMA
people
was
were
a
being,
huge problem.
can you talk about that a little? People were being evicted even though their houses were not damaged, and they were being evicted because of the basically economic situation had gotten so much worse, which already was a disaster. I mean, New Orleans, it must be said, this country was a disaster prior to the pandemic, as New Orleans was prior to Hurricane Katrina, economic and social health disaster. But then what was going on with the evictions? I mean, in terms of like, was the anti-eviction organizing successful?
We went and organized in certain like apartment complexes where the landlords were basically trying to kick out the tenants that were there because they wanted to get some grant money, that was being given out to renovate and bring in higher income tenants that they could charge more. So we did organize. It was successful. People stayed in those apartments that we were organizing in, and it became more widespread. There were direct actions, people going and locking down in front of the landlord's offices and saying no evictions, occupying and staying in apartments that people were being evicted from. And so that was successful in some of the housing that we were working in. Of course, later this was used as an excuse to tear down public housing in New Orleans. So a lot of the public housing was actually where people went to seek refuge because they were brick as opposed to wood. And so people went into the public housing to try and get shelter from the hurricane, and those buildings stood, but later was they were torn down in order to get rid of public housing,
And this
and the same
lesson,
thing
I mean,
happened with the school system.
the school system, this, I mean, this, what we're talking about here also, I mean, just, backing up for a moment, and the meta, is used the way that the authorities used this massive calamity in New Orleans to actually, and many capitalists and home, people that own real estate investors, and they use this catastrophe to actually profit from it and also make the city less welcoming and less inhabitable to poor and working class people, and more of a, it actually became a white majority city, and this is a terrible reflection on the current situation, if things might go in that direction. Although it's I don't know. Please, what were you saying about the schools?
Well, the hyper capitalists used that as an opportunity to privatize the schools, to use the charter school system to turn the school system into a for-profit enterprise. I mean, we had kids helping with Common Ground, and it was more of an education than I think that they had ever gotten, just like learning from each other. But that kind of brings me back to the education system in general, where what I had written about in my studying is that, well, they call it pedagogy when you study the art of learning and how people learn and figure out what Naomi Alderich says is pedagogy is basically explaining how to force kids and people to learn things they don't want to learn. So as I went into the master's of education, it was all about, I mean, luckily I was in a really good program that was challenging the prevailing knowledge and the prevailing theories about schooling, and looking at people like Ivan Illich and Rachel Carson. We did a lot of that kind of looking at pedagogies that are outside of the system. And for me, it came to what I call the pedagogy of the edges, that where learning actually takes place is on the edges. So when you look at permaculture theory and design, they're always talking about the edges, what's on, not in the middle, but where things meet and where things transition and change. And that's where the learning takes place. It's not in a classroom. It's not when you're sitting. And I know I didn't learn a lot in the classroom. I remember many, many hours of being bored in school and just sitting there and writing until my hand cramped and just hating it. But I love learning. And so there's a real disconnect there from learning and school. And most of the things that I have learned, I learned outside of school. And I think that's something that as parents are observing their kids more now and not having them at school, or maybe realizing that the things that they really want to learn, they're going to pursue. Unfortunately, we have this mediated experience of the screens and these highly addictive devices being in the hands of most of our children now, pull them away from their desire to learn. Some children are able to kind of get through that mediated experience and pursue the things that they want to learn, look for, you know, the how-to videos on YouTube to find the things that they want to learn. But a lot of people, young people, have a really hard time with that addictive quality of these games and things. And so it's so the manipulation is going on, and it's going on through the school system, and it's going on through the online teaching and the games that are being pushed on the kids. So what we when I talk about learning happening at the edges, I'm talking about moments like this. So where society breaks down, where big bursts of learning happen. Like we had a kid in New Orleans at the Common Ground a camp where we were doing a lot of our work, and we were setting up computers. So we're trying to put together a computer lab so that people could then access their FEMA applications and the internet. And here's this 11, 12-year-old kid who is just learning everything he can about computers and trying to put them together and trying to, you know, figure out how to program them and the back end of it. And that is a real like surge in learning, that if you didn't have that situation where we're all like working together to push this thing, and I'm learning about, you know, as I'm putting up the mesh networks for the antennas, I didn't know about mesh networks before. I knew how to put up an antenna, but there's in these moments of crisis, that's when there are a lot of moments of learning as well. And so people connect in new ways, and then really pursue what they are interested in. And that's, that's how real learning takes place.
Yeah. It's like the I often talk about the project orientation as opposed to the sort of rote learning orientation that we're all trying to be, you know, they're trying to force us all into, that we all sort of adapt to one degree or another, usually not very well. But then those of us who are more what the society often refers to as artists or ADHD or whatever labels they give to those of us who don't fit in their, you know, in the way that they try to structure this educational system. You know, I think, you know, I've heard a lot of reports about children, despite the social isolation, doing really well. Those kids who are more sort of haven't had the spirit of learning killed by the educational system yet, and they still have an orientation towards projects and learning new skills and diving into it until they master it and that kind of thing, which is sort of, as I think of it, a more normal way for our brains to function. When you get into something, you learn it and you get good at it, and you don't move from one subject to the next every 45 minutes, you know. But Jenka, in terms of the, I want to talk about a little about communication, because like in terms of how we're like when we're talking about these ideas and talking about communicating ideas, especially when we're talking about communicating ideas remotely, which is particularly relevant right now, but something you've been involved with for decades in one form or another, and the forms of communication and the ways that we've been able to attempt to use different forms of communication at coming out of various, all kinds of different crises as well, in terms of, like, you could say that the crisis of the print media, the crisis of the music industry, crisis of many other industries that have been disrupted by more modern forms of communication, like, you know, we could say really, really broadly, like by the internet, I suppose, but that's too broad a concept, I think, when we're talking about this. But maybe, I don't know, but like I'm thinking about in terms of your involvement with indie media and then how things have changed over the past 20 years in terms of like the dominance of so-called social media. I mean, I see like your job technically at KABU actually has the word social media in it. You know, what is social media and how has this evolved over the past couple of decades? Is it true, as Ben Ford said, that capitalism is now hegemonic in terms of control of our means of communication? I heard him say that in a speech last fall.
Yes and no. I mean, capitalism has a certain level of control and mediation over our social networks, but we're at an unprecedented time when people are communicating in ways that they never have before, across borders and you know, internationally in really creative ways. So I don't see the spread of social media as our downfall. I see that it has, again, its pluses and minuses. And I think that indie media, we've been talking about this, it's been the 20th anniversary in December. And so a lot of people have been talking about indie media and what role it played. And it was really the first open publishing site on the internet. So you had GeoCities or places where people could maybe create their own website, but to have actual open publishing where you just type something and there it is on the internet. You just put a picture and there it is on the internet. It's really hard to think back now when we have Instagram and we have all of this the social media to a time when that didn't exist. And I think that indie media played the role of opening that and saying, this is what the internet is for. It's not to be a space where just, you know, a corporate entity can create their website and sell their products. It's a way for us to communicate to each other in an unmediated way, like without editors, without people at the top giving directives, but just sharing information. And that exploded into what's now become, you know, YouTube and podcasts and you know, the photo sharing and the Instagram and the Facebook, and those things emerged out of that idea that the internet is open publishing. It is us communicating on a peer-to-peer level. So there's a lot of ways that has emerged, and most of them are these kind of controlled, mediated corporate companies that control the that own the means of communication, not necessarily the communication itself, because people don't think about the company when they're communicating with their friends, but it is still there is that mediating factor in between, and that Twitter gets subpoenaed, then yeah, they're going to share all your private messages. If Facebook, has an idea of how to sell you advertising, they're going to utilize it. And so we end up with the social media that we have, which is really problematic. The problem isn't social media itself. The problem is the companies that run it.
Yeah, right. Well, do you have an idea for a solution to that problem, by the way? Like,
Well,
and
I
I mean, in
think
terms of like social media, like, I mean, I've heard people talk about, maybe it was you I heard talking about this, I can't remember it, but I heard somebody talking about the idea of a sort of social media being treated like a public utility.
yes. Well, I think Google should be definitely considered a public utility as a like purveyor of many of the things that we use on the internet. Like that is something that should be a public, just a public entity, like a public library. You have access to it, and there's no company controlling it. And so yes, I think that it should be public. But also, as an anarchist, I don't think there should be a government ultimately. Like I think that we need to get beyond this idea that that turning things over to a federal bureaucracy is going to somehow solve it. It's not. What we
As I
have
mean,
is
as a
something
public
different.
utility, that could take so many different forms, right? It could be just something that we have an agreed upon set of rules for how it functions, and then we have people maintaining the network, and then it can work like that, right? It doesn't need to be a top down hierarchical structure running it.
Yeah, and there are great things that I think are run not necessarily by the government, but I love libraries. I think libraries are amazing, amazing things, and that they should be maintained in whatever society we envision and create. I love the Postal Service, and yeah, it isn't funded by the federal government. So people in the Congress who want to bankrupt it, you've got an entity here that is actually independent and is created in the Constitution, because this is, I don't think Jefferson ever envisioned what we have now, but this would be the logical extension of the Postal Service. Okay, this the internet is the logical extension of our communication tool between each other. So, when the 1776, when they're sending letters by Pony Express to reach someone, this is the modern equivalent. And so when we look at the Constitution, that the Postal Service is a enshrined in the Constitution, it's not something that can be gotten rid of. This is talking about the internet, if you take it to its logical conclusion. And so yes, it should be protected as a public entity, as something that everyone has equal access to. And by equal access, I don't mean 5G. I don't mean something that is untested and that is then controlled by a major company and can cause radiation in our neighborhoods and all kinds of other problems. I mean, an infrastructure that works, that we can use, that it isn't dangerous to us, and that isn't owned by a big corporation, but that allows everybody equal access to it. So,
And Jenka, if you ran, I know you're an anarchist, and I'm an anarchist as well. But just very hypothetically, if you ran a country, like China, for example, I mean, or a small country or whatever, like when we talk about the free discourse and the internet and how it could be structured and how it could, social media could be a public utility and how it actually is in terms of these corporations where they're spending billions of dollars a year on making sure to get us more addicted and more confused and to feed us advertising and feed us controversy. It seems to me that if I were running a country, banning Facebook and is not a is a fairly sensible move, really, in a way. Isn't it? What do you think of that?
China's not a small country.
No, but it's a very, very big country. But other countries large and small, have banned Facebook.
I think I get the idea of what you're talking about. And to me, it's not a matter of banning any particular thing. It's getting people unaddicted to it, and to see that they don't actually need that, that there are other tools, and Facebook probably isn't the best one. As we talk to each other on Facebook, I'm just reminded when you're talking about how to run a country and have open communication and technology, I just keep thinking back to my time with the Zapatistas in southern Mexico, who have an autonomous region and are very selective about the technology that they use. So when an Italian group came to set up a hydroelectric generating plant for them in La Realidad, they said, well, first of all, we want to have a generating plant that the turbines don't hurt the fish. So so we have to figure out a way to make that sustainable. And we only want to generate enough power to have like two computers in the village and lights. And that's it. We don't need more than that. And so they're very selective about what they want and how they want to use technology. And so when it is put in, it's not what the kind of nonprofit industrial complex colonial mentality wants to foist on them. It's what they're asking for and what they're demanding. So in the work that I was doing, setting up radios, the idea is, well, we want to communicate with each other. So we want to have antennas, you know, in these different places. And what's the purpose of it is to, you know, to share our the information and to have our assemblies be more democratic so that we can reach each other. The idea of connecting to the internet is one of, we want to share our way of doing things and our, you know, the things that we're doing here, the way we're living autonomously on the land, the way we have developed over tens of thousands of years a system of agriculture, or don't really call it agriculture because agriculture has been co-opted by commercial interests, but just farming that actually works with the land and is sustainable. We want to share that with the world. And so we'll use the internet for that. Other than that, not really that useful.
Oh, interesting. And Jenka, talk more about what the role of radio too, because I know radio has played a tremendous role in liberation struggles from the Zapatistas to the FMLN to many other to the struggle in Vietnam and many other national liberation struggles, but also just in terms of like radio locally in communities like Portland. Like, I mean, I find, as much as I'm spending, I've been online so much of the past, you know, 25 years, I, you know, as the internet develops, I find that one of the main things I do with the internet is listen to radio stations. You know, it's just not necessarily a local one, but.
You know, it's interesting. Every movie that you see about like the post-apocalypse and like everything, there's some guy in a cave, right, putting up a radio antenna and talking. Is there anyone out there? Because radio is what will survive. You know, if all of everything else fails, because we can do it through the airwaves. Just set up an antenna and you've got a radio, and the receivers also are not that hard to make. So that, you know, if a basic knowledge of electronics, you can put together a radio receiver and receive it without having to, you know, get your silicon and have the sweatshops in China building processors and putting together this whole infrastructure of computer networking, or having to get coltan from the Congo to make your capacitors for your cell phones, which is what we are stuck with now. It's very simple technology, and it can be done even with Morse code. So if you don't have the capacity to do voice, you can do Morse code. So this is a way that we communicate locally and nationally, internationally, that can be done on a shoestring budget and very simply. And when the Zapatistas use it, I think this is a great idea and a great thought, is they have their assembleas, their you know, assemblies that, where they make all of their decisions, and they don't have a voting age. I know right now people are like, oh, we shouldn't lower the voting age to 16. Well, in the Zapatistas, everybody participates, and sometimes the most insightful ideas in the work that they do and the decisions that they're making come from like 5, 6, 7 year olds, because they're listening and they're contributing. So I think that this idea that we have a separation of people from 18 and up and then 17 and under is a kind of ridiculous separation in our society, where we can learn from communities that do it another way, like the Zapatistas. So they use the radio to communicate the asambleas for people who aren't able to participate locally, like in whatever village they are taking place in. But they can hear their delegates, that each village will send a delegate, and they'll you know, be able to be a part of the real democratic process, the direct democratic process, unlike ours, but actually listening to, okay, we're making a decision about where to, you know, we need to build a road, you know, or we need to supply water to a certain place. So how are we going to do this as a community? Here's the resources we have. How are we going to do it? And those are then shared on the radio, so that people can participate remotely. So, a way that democracy can work. And when this federal system breaks down and we are, you know, in our own communities trying to work with each other, that's one tool that we can use to communicate, and one of many. I think with the internet, we have a lot more, and we could be doing direct democracy. We could.
It's more possible now than ever, perhaps, really, with the internet, huh?
Absolutely.
Jenka, I want to thank you so much for participating in my little show. I'm just going to see if I can get the image back so people can see you moving one more time. And I know you have something else happening at the top of the hour. But it's been great having you here. And you know, speaking of communication methods, I've been finding that one of the other neat things about like in terms of the local aspect of radio, that actually broadcasting on a Facebook page or other social media account of an organization, you end up kind of having, there's a kind of a local aspect to it. Like my guess is that most of the people who are following KBOO's Facebook page actually live in the Portland area. So it's, yeah. There is an aspect of that that's interestingly local as well, even though it's not as local as a radio signal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think like the one point that I want to leave is that I've traveled to a lot of places, done a lot of activism around the world. And yeah, there is, you know, fear, there is war, there are all of these horrible things happening. And they're done in a systematic way in order to keep people oppressed. Everywhere I have been, there are good people resisting that, and there are people who realize that this is a huge problem, and that we need to take it on ourselves to do something about it. And so, right now, I know a lot of people are fearful. Don't let the fear guide you. Understand that we ourselves are the solution. If we work together and we talk to our neighbors, and we talk to the people that we know, and we communicate and we figure out ways, we will find better ways than the system that we have now.
Really good advice. And then let's get back on here in a few weeks and talk about the developments of the past few weeks, of which there will be plenty to discuss, I'm sure. Yeah. And we haven't even mentioned various other notable locations that you've spent quite a bit of time in and have a lot of knowledge about. But that is the nature of the one-hour show. I've been finding actually an hour is not very long, and life is much bigger than this, which is nice because it leaves us plenty of time to talk about other things for future hours. But I gave up on trying to compress everything into an hour and like, you know, get somebody's life story, because it just doesn't work. So. We'll just have to talk again.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Thanks so much, Jenka. Talk to you soon. And that was Jenka Soderberg. And this has been another episode of Discussions with David. You can find these archived in the Discussions with David playlist on my YouTube channel by looking in the video section on my Facebook page or the Facebook page of Popular Resistance, as well as on Twitter, Twitch, VK, LinkedIn, at davidrovics.com/quarantine, and in podcast form, if you search for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform. You can also find the podcast front and center on the David Rovics mobile app. The next live stream I have planned will be the third in the weekly Pandemic Open Mic Mondays series of online open mics. If you've got a song or poem or rant to share, please sign up at davidrovics.com/POMM. If you want to support my live streaming, songwriting, recording, and other such efforts, whether there's a depression on or not, or if you're able to, then please go to davidrovics.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovics. Thank you so much for listening, for your support, for existing. Keep on keeping on. Hope to see you soon. Don't pay the rent. Stay safe. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.